And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West. The most haunted city in the country. Well, today's December 17th. 351st day of the year. 14 days remain till the year's over with. I was listening to NPR. And with people dying from COVID and all the issues that this country has, all the media can think about is lynching former President Trump. It's crazy. We got a current president that his own people say they're not going to put up to run in 2024. He wants to bankrupt the country. And all the media can do is Trump did this and Trump did that and Trump did the other and we need to lynch Trump and yada, 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 yada. It's just crazy. Trump derangement syndrome is full blown. Well, on this day in 497 BC, the first Saturnalia festival celebrated in ancient Rome. Now, for those who are not familiar with it, it's an ancient Roman festival and holiday in honor of the god Saturn. Is held on December 17th of the Julian calendar and later expanded with festivities through the 23rd of December. Holiday was celebrated with a sacrifice at the Temple of Saturn in the Roman Forum, then a public banquet, followed by private gift-giving, continual partying in a carnival atmosphere that overturned Roman social norms. Gambling was permitted. Masters provided table service for their servants as it was seen at a time of liberty for both slaves and freedmen alike. Common custom was the election of the king of Saturnalia, who would give orders to the people, which would be followed and presided over the merrymaking. Now, the gifts exchanged were usually gag gifts, or small figurines made of wax or pottery known as sigillaria. The poet Catullus called it the best of days. And certainly, it was a difference of how things were done in Rome. In 546, the siege of Rome. The Ostrogoths, under King Totila, plundered the city. They bribed the Byzantine garrison to let them move unimpeded through the city. 920, Romanos I, the Capinos, is crowned co-emperor of the underage Constantine VII. 942, we saw the assassination of William I of Normandy. 1398, Sultan Nasir ud-Din Mahmud's armies in Delhi are defeated by Timur. 1538, Pope Paul III excommunicates Henry VIII of England. And Henry, rather than kowtowing, said, I'll start my own religion. Screw you. Well, 1583, the Cologne War. Forces under Ernest of Bavaria defeat troops under Gebhard Truchsess von Waldburg at the siege of Gottesburg. 1586, Go-Yozai becomes Emperor of Japan. 1718, War of the Quadruple Alliance. Great Britain declares war on Spain. 1777, American Revolution. On this date, France formally recognizes the U.S. 1790, the Aztec calendar stones discovered in El Zocalo in Mexico City. 1807, Napoleonic Wars. France issues the Milan Decree. It confirms the continental system. The continental system was the, also known as the continental blockade, was the foreign policy of Napoleon Bonaparte against the UK during Napoleonic Wars. As a response to the naval blockade of the French coast enacted by the British government, May 16, 1806, Napoleon issued the Berlin Decree, November 21, 1806, that brought into effect a large-scale embargo against British trade. The embargo was applied intermittently, ending April 11, 1814, after Napoleon's first abdication. Caused little economic damage to the UK, also, although British exports to the continent dropped from 55% to 25%. War of 1812, U.S. forces attack the Lenape village in the Battle of Mississinew, 1819, Simon Bolivar declares the independence of Gran Colombia and Angostura. It's now Ciudad Bolivar in Venezuela. 1835, the Second Great Fire of New York destroys 53,000 square meters, that's 13 acres, of New York City's financial district. Unfortunately, it came back. 1837, a fire in the Winter Palace of St. Petersburg kills 30 guards. 1862, American Civil War. President Grant issues General Order 11, expelling Jews from parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Kentucky. And I'm shocked that Grant lowered himself to deal with such issues. 1865, first performance of the Unfinished Symphony by Franz Schubert. 1892, the first issue of Vogue is published. 1896, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Schenley Park Casino, which was the first multi-purpose arena with the technology to create an artificial ice surface in North America, is destroyed in a fire. 1903, the Wright brothers made the first controlled, powered, heavier-than-air flight in the Wright Flyer at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. 1907, Ugyen Wangchuck is crowned the first king of Bhutan. 1918, Darwin Rebellion. Up to 1,000 demonstrators march on Government House in Darwin, Northern Territory in Australia. 1919, Uruguay becomes a signatory of the Buenos Aires Copyright Treaty. 1926, Antanas Smetona assumes power in Lithuania as a 1926 coup d'etat is successful. 1927, Indian revolutionary Rajendra Lahiri is hung in Gandha Jail, Uttar Pradesh, India, 2 days before the scheduled date. 1928, Indian revolutionaries Bhagat Singh, Sukhdev Thapar, and Sivaram Rajguru assassinate British police officer James Saunders in Lahore, Punjab, to avenge the death of Lala Lajput Rai at the hands of the police. Those three were executed in 1931. 1933, first NFL championship game is played at Wrigley Field in Chicago between the New York Giants and the Chicago Bears. The Bears won 23-21. 1935, the first flight of the Douglas DC-3. 1938, Otto Hahn discovers the nuclear fission of the heavy element uranium, the scientific and technological basis of nuclear energy. 1939, World War II, Battle of the River Platte. The Admiral Graf Spree is scuttled by Captain Hans Langsdorff outside Montevideo. He thought he was surrounded. He wasn't, but he thought he was. 1943, all Chinese are again permitted to become citizens of the U.S. upon repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 and the introduction of the Magnuson Act. Since they were our allies during World War II, it was kind of silly to ban them from the U.S. 1944, Battle of the Bulge, the Malmedy Massacre. American 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion POWs are shot by Waffen SF Crump Group Joachim Piper. 1946, Kurdistan Flag Day. The flag of Kurdistan was raised for the first time in Mahabad in eastern Kurdistan, which is now Iran. 1947, first flight of the Boeing B-47 Stratojet Strategic Bomber. 1948, the Finnish security police is established to remove communist leadership from its predecessor, the state police. 1950, the F-86 Sabre's first mission over Korea. 1951, the American Civil Rights Congress delivers "We Charge Genocide" to the United Nations. 1957, U.S. successfully launches the first Atlas intercontinental ballistic missile at Cape Canaveral, Florida. 1960, troops loyal to Emperor Haile Selassie in Ethiopia crush the coup that began December 13th, returning power to their leader upon his return from his trip to Brazil, and he absolves his son of any guilt in the matter. The troops that initiated the coup d'etat put his son in as emperor in his place. 1960, Munich C-131 crash. 20 passengers and crew on board, as well as 32 people on the ground, are killed. As I've said before, you know you're having a bad day when a plane falls on you. 1961, Nitterau Circus fire. Fire breaks out during a performance by the Grand Circus Norte Americano in the city of Nitterau, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. More than 500 people die in that fire. 1967, Harold Holt, Prime Minister of Australia, disappears while swimming near Port C, Victoria. He's presumed to be drowned, but they never found the body. 17th Prime Minister of Australia. He ruled from 1966 until he vanished in 1967. He was elected unopposed as Liberal leader. 1967 in December 1967 while swimming in rough conditions. He's presumed dead, although the body was never recovered. His disappearance, of course, spawned a number of conspiracy theories. He was the third Australian Prime Minister to die in office. The sad thing is, we'll never know what happened to him. I mean, Australia has long since given up trying to determine what might have happened to him. 1969, Project Blue Book. The U.S. Air Force closes its UFO study officially. Unofficially, it's still going on. 1970, Polish protest. And got in the soldiers fire at workers emerging from trains. They killed dozens of people. 1973, 30 passengers are killed in an attack by Palestinian terrorists on Rome's Leonardo da Vinci Fiumicino Airport. 1981, American Brigadier General James Dozier is abducted by the Red Brigade in Verona, Italy. 1983, provisional IRA members detonate a car bomb at Harrods department store in London. 3 police officers and 3 civilians are killed. If you've never been to Harrods department store, it's interesting. 1989, Romanian Revolution. Protests continue in Timișoara, Romania, with rioters breaking into the Romanian Communist Party's district committee building and attempting to set it on fire. 1989, Fernando Collor de Mellor defeats Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in the second round of the Brazilian presidential election. Becomes the first democratically elected president in almost 30 years. 1989, The Simpsons premieres on TV with the episode Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. 1997, Aeroswit Flight 241. A Yakovlev Yak-42 crashes into the Pyrenean Mountains near Thessalonica Airport in Thessalonica, Greece. All 70 people on board are killed. 2002, the Second Congo War. Congolese parties of inter-Congolese dialogue sign a peace accord that makes provisions for transitional governments and legislative and presidential elections within 2 years. 2003, the Soha murder trial ends at the Old Bailey in London, with Ian Huntley found guilty of 2 counts of murder. His girlfriend, Maxine Carr, is found guilty of perverting the course of justice. That particular murder case was a double child murder committed in Soham, Cambridgeshire, England. The victims were 2 10-year-old girls, Holly Marie Wells and Jessica Amy Chapman. They were lured into the home of a local resident, Ian Kevin Huntley, who subsequently murdered them, likely by asphyxiation, it was thought, before disposing of their bodies in the irrigation ditch close to RAF Lakenheath in Suffolk. Girls' bodies were discovered August 17, 2002. He was convicted of murder December 17th and sentenced to 2 terms of life imprisonment, with the High Court later imposing a minimum term of 40 years. His girlfriend, Maxine Ann Carr, the girl's teaching assistant, had knowingly provided Huntley with a false alibi. She got a 3.5-year sentence for conspiring to pervert the course of justice. The efforts made to locate the two girls in the 13 days of their disappearance have been described as one of the most intense and extensive in British criminal history. If you have to resort to killing children, that's kind of bad. All right. 2003, Spaceship One, piloted by Brian Benny, makes its first powered and first supersonic flight. 2003, sex work rights activists established December 17th as International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers to memorialize victims of a serial killer who targeted prostitutes and to highlight state violence against sex workers by police and others. 2005, Anti-World Trade Organization protesters riot in Wan Chai in Hong Kong. 2005, Jagme Signi Wenchuk abdicates the throne as King of Bhutan. 2009, the MV Danny F2 sinks off the coast of Lebanon. 44 people died, over 28,000 animals die. 2010, Mohammed Bouazizi sets himself on fire. This becomes the catalyst for the Tunisian Revolution and the wider Arab Spring. 2014, the U.S. and Cuba reestablished diplomatic relations after severing them in 1961. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Daniel the Prophet, Joseph Magna Yenet, Evives, Lazarus of Bethany, local commemoration in Cuba, O Sapientia, Olympias the Deaconess, Wavina, Sturm, Accession Day in Bahrain, International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, Kurdish Flag Day among the global Kurdish population. In Bhutan, it's National Day. In the U.S., it's Pan-American Aviation Day. And the Wright Brothers Day, which is a federal observance by presidential proclamation. I guess the president felt he had to do something rather than sit on his ass. All righty. Let's see what else we might have. Ta-ta-tum-tum-tum. 2011, North Korean ruler Kim Jong-il dies, succeeded by his youngest son, Kim Jong-un. In 2010, Mohammed Bouazizi, who set himself on fire, was a Tunisian street vendor. He was harassed by municipal officials. His act gave rise to Tunisia's Jasmine Revolution. In 1992, the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed by the leaders of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., replaced by the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement of 2020. NAFTA has been described as one of the biggest screw job of American workers. 1910, American jazz trumpeter, composer, and bandleader Cy Oliver, one of the leading musical arrangements of the 30s and 40s, was born in Battle Creek, Michigan. 1853, Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, one of the great figures at English theatre and the most successful actor manager of his time, was born in London. And in 1760, American Revolutionary soldier Deborah Sampson, who assumed a man's identity in order to join the 4th Massachusetts Regiment, was born. Something I read said she did it to be with her husband or boyfriend. This day in 2019, President Trump became the 3rd U.S. president to be impeached by the House of Representatives. They charged him with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Same thing's going on right now, but it's okay because, you know, Biden's a god. And I'm not anti-Biden. I'm not pro-Biden. 2011, Czech playwright, poet, and political dissident Václav Havel, who served as president of Czechoslovakia and of the Czech Republic and had been a prominent participant in the liberal reforms in 1968, known as the Prague Spring, died in the Czech Republic on this date. 1997, Kim Dae-jung, elected president of South Korea, first opposition leader in that country's history to win that position. 1966, the TV special How the Grinch Stole Christmas, an adaptation of Dr. Seuss's classic children's book, aired for the first time, became a holiday staple. I saw a sign the other day in front of a library. Dr. Seuss was making a public appearance, which I thought was interesting since he's dead. This day in 1946, American film director Steven Spielberg was born. He spent $140 million doing a remake of West Side Story, and it's made 10. The 1917 German General Erich Ludendorff ordered a consolidation of the country's leading motion picture studios to form Universum Film Acten. Let's see. This day in 1912, the discovery of fossil remains of Piltdown Man, an extinct human species, was announced at a meeting of the Geological Society of London. But later, those remains are proved to be a fraud. In 1787, on this date, New Jersey became the 3rd state admitted to the Union when it ratified the Constitution. And in 1737, famed violin maker Antonio Stradivari died in Cremona. If you find a Stradivarius, your future is pretty much assured. All right, we finished our little history segment. We've been talking about strange things. You know, for centuries, India's been noted for its fascinating enigmas, the land of magic and malarkey, as it's been called. Some of the strangest stories don't stand up well under scrutiny. Let's start in 1756, when the last of the native princes of India had risen to in defiance of the British East India Company. It was a brave gesture, but a futile one. Thousands of untrained men, native troops as they were called, flung themselves in mass against the guns and bayonets of the British. Old story of spears against rifles. Though I will say the Ethiopians beat the Italian army in the 30s, and that was native troops with spears. But in talking about the untrained Indian troops, it was a spectacle not to be repeated on such a scale till the Italians went into Ethiopia almost 2 centuries later. Now, the British problem was to lure the natives into pitched battles where British guns could easily decide the issue. Now, time after time, they did achieve this. And time after time, the Indian troops retreated from the field after staggering losses. Of course, the superiority of the British guns was countered by the fanatical zeal of the natives, and they appeared to have an endless supply of manpower.
But not every battle ended in victory for the British. From time to time, the Indian troops eluded them or poured into the fighting in such numbers the British had to retreat to avoid being overwhelmed. It was the night of June 20, 1756, that a detachment of British troops became separated from their comrades in the ebb and flow of battle. They formed their lines around a little knoll, but the gathering darkness made their muskets useless. The elephants trumpeted and charged, and they wound up surrendering to the Nawab of Siraj. British stacked their guns and marched off to prison. Actually, they were marching into the pages of history, making their entrance through a non-existent aperture called the Black Hole of Calcutta. Now, this legend defied truth for almost 200 years. Now, since most historians simply copy from other historians, the legend of the Calcutta atrocity has lived on. When I was in school, we heard about it. The conventional story from the conventional history book says that 146 of these British troops are jammed into a room, 14 by 18, and 123 of them died during the night. They suffocated, don't you know? Now, some historians go on to add the additional details, how the victims are packed together so tightly the dead couldn't fall to the floor, and how at daybreak the dead and the living still stood together. This was the infamous Black Hole of Calcutta, an atrocious fabrication that still lives on in the pages of history, thanks to plagiarism. Careful research for both British and Indian governments disclosed the falsity of the Black Hole of Calcutta story. It was, in fact, just another rumor spread to infuriate the British people, especially the British troops. Further investigation revealed that most of the British prisoners who supposedly died in that hole actually lived a ripe old age in England. The whole fraudulent story had been concocted by a minor officer at the British Embassy years after the alleged events supposed to have happened. Correspondents quoted him, historians quoted the correspondence, and so on and so forth. In 1900, a board of inquiry consisting of eminent scholars from seven nations presented to the British governor of India irrefutable proof that the widely publicized atrocity at Calcutta was a lie, perpetuated by an irresponsible minor official as propaganda. And the suffocated victims had gone back to England, as shown by British Army records. Well, with typical British thoroughness, the governor considered the evidence carefully and then gave his decision. On the spot where the atrocity never happened, he poured a great slab of concrete and engraved with the lurid and fictitious details. It was as imperishable as the story was in the history books, a memorial to a lie. Now, the Calcutta story is on par with that of the Wolf Girl of Midnapore, first recorded for credulous Americans by Dr. Gazelle, writing in Harper's Magazine in 1930. He says his investigation showed that a female wolf near Midnapore in India had adopted a small human baby had been left in out in the open to die. And the animal later took the infant back to her den. Now, being an avid researcher, Dr. Gazelle left no rug unturned. He discussed the fact that the wolf den had no furniture, no books, no rugs, no dishes. True table manners are completely lacking. Now, having gone to great lengths to enlighten folks on the lack of culture in the wolf den, he goes on to say the abandoned baby learned to eat by putting the food directly into her mouth and chewing. A procedure that has, in fact, been adopted by infants in many lands. Child learned to run on all fours. Was captured by Reverend J.L. Singh of Midnapore, where she lived until 1929. Each night at 10, he said, she went out and howled. Well, 1929 she died, but her death was only physical because the story of Kamala, the wolf girl of Midnapore, still exists to this day. It's been reprinted in the pages of Coronet, the Saturday Evening Post, Collier, Scientific American, and a number of others, which have never bothered to check a few simple facts. We've all taken Dr. Gazelle at his word. Well, unfortunately for the story, the facts that it reports betray it. In that part of India, there were no wolves. And a little bit of research could have revealed that. And a child wasn't found among the wolves, but she was found on an anthill. And the fact she slept curled up proved she had a flexible backbone and not much else. And Dr. Gazelle hangs his story by stating it happened in the tiger-infested jungles of northwest India. Actually, Mindapore is on the opposite side of India. It's only 70 miles from Calcutta. Now, Kamala the wolf girl was probably an abandoned child. Not overly bright, but smart enough not to write magazine articles without at least first seeing where the place is on a map. Well, there's a lot of stories that have been repeated time and time again. One is about the song that is said to have written itself. Abraham Lincoln called it the song that saved the Union. The lady that wrote it called it the song that wrote itself. And there are those that say both were right. The song is the battle hymn of the Republic, one of the most stirring songs ever written. Lincoln is said to have cried the first time he heard it during the darkest days of the Civil War. The music, the battle hymn, came from an old Southern camp meeting song. The title of it was "Say, Brother, Will You Meet Us on Canaan's Happy Shore?" But where the words came from is quite another story, and it's said to be a very strange story. On the night of November 18, 1861, the fog from the nearby Potomac River was drifting through the streets of Washington, D.C. Long lines of dispirited Union soldiers shuffled past Willard's Hotel. Some had been were stumbling because they'd been marching all day, marching with heavy hearts from the defeats of yesterday to the uncertainties of tomorrow. In a corner room of Willard's Hotel, the red-haired wife of a Boston social leader sat beside her window in that darkened room, watching those long lines of troops trudging past in the evening. Ordinarily, Julia Ward Howe would have been asleep at this hour. But this wasn't an ordinary occasion by any means. Fate had chosen her for a strange mission. The yellow rays from the gas light on the corner gleamed fitfully on the gun barrels and bayonets of the marching troops. She was watching a living panorama for a long time before she decided to go to bed. She was exhausted from her long train ride from Boston and slept soundly. Just before daylight, though, she found herself sitting at the writing desk in the corner of the room. She wrote rapidly, which is unusual for her. Before this, she'd always found rhyming difficult, but on this cold, gray dawn, her pen flew across the paper, scratching out the lines that were to make her name live in history. So dark in that room, she could scarcely see the paper, but she didn't bother to light the candle. She wrote as if she was inspired. If it was her mission in life, she was fulfilling it magnificently. Long after daylight, when she had awakened, she found that she had written a poem of 5 verses on a sheet of stationery from the Sanitary Commission. That was the government agency where her husband worked. She recalled vaguely sitting at the desk, but remembered nothing of what she'd written. But there it was. So well written, she felt compelled to change only 4 words in the entire work. It was entitled "The Battle Hymn of the Republic." But she couldn't recall either the verses or the title. So what was she to do with this moving piece of work? Well, she mailed it to the Atlantic Monthly. It was published as a poem in the February issue, 1862. She got the magnificent sum of $4 for her work. Well, great songs, like great men and great ideas, have to arrive on the scene at exactly the right time and place. And so it was with this particular masterpiece. Her forceful and moving little poem fell into the hands of Chaplain Charles McCabe of the 112th Ohio Volunteers. He had it in his pocket when he was captured at Winchester and sent to Libby Prison. McCabe noticed Ms. Howe's poem fit perfectly to the time of Tomb of John Brown's Body, which had been borrowed from the John Brown's Body was another song that had been borrowed from the old Southern song on Canaan's Happy Shore. Well, McCabe sang battle hymn to his fellow prisoners, and pretty soon they were singing it with him. One night when the Confederate guard told the prisoners the rebels had just won another smashing victory in Pennsylvania, the prisoners were sunk in gloom. But a few minutes later, another trustee who served in the officers' mess at the garrison brought in a real story. The Union had actually won a great victory at a little town called Gettysburg. So McCabe and his fellow prisoners sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Months later, McCabe was released as an exchange prisoner sent back to D.C. There in a theater, he told the audience of his experiences in Libby prison and of the song that shook the walls. And he sang it for him. And suddenly, they were singing it with him. President Lincoln got to his feet, tears streaming down his cheeks, and asked them to sing it again. Well, Julia Ward Howe later said of her masterpiece, "I wonder if I really wrote it. I don't think I did. I just put an instrument. Really wrote itself." When she died in 1910 at the age of 91, a chorus of 100 little children from the Perkins Institute for the Blind told her goodbye as they softly sang that song. Well, we've talked about psychics, and we've talked about psychics who solve crimes. But could a victim actually solve her own murder? Well, the police were desperate after weeks of investigation. They'd failed to solve the disappearance of Joy Aiken. Did she tell them where to find her killer? According to police records, she did. Now, science is admittedly operating under difficulties when it endeavors to explore the realm of the mind. The very nature of the study precludes success in many respects. Science has learned a great deal about the mind in the past decades, thanks to new instruments and new techniques, but when you reduce it to the fundamentals, it becomes a program of the mind studying the mind, and that complicates the problem. We know the human mind is capable of some remarkable feats, which you can only record without really understanding how they work. That it may also be capable of other and even more incredible attainments has long been a matter of public debate. As an example of this, we're going to talk about the case of Joy Aiken, found in the police records of Pinetown, Natal, South Africa. The date, October 9th, 1956. This story was attested to by 4 police officials and 46 invited witnesses. Now, Joy Aiken was a few days past her 17th birthday when she vanished in mid-September 1956. She was a very pretty girl, also very shy, had no steady boyfriend, and certainly didn't have any enemies. So the question became, why had she disappeared? Well, her family suspected foul play, and the police concurred. They sent out bulletins bearing her picture to police posts throughout South Africa. A reward was offered for anybody who could provide information leading to the finding of the girl or her body. Well, the weeks passed without any results. There were, of course, a few crank tips, the usual crackpot reports that are to be expected when a reward is posted. And as usual, a little bit of investigation showed they came to naught. She vanished as completely as if the earth had swallowed her up, which police suspected might well be true. Well, the missing girl's brother, Colin Aiken, visited the police station in Pinetown each day and hoped that they might have learned something that would lead him to the end of the search, whatever it might be. They just wanted an end put to it, whether she was dead or alive. They just wanted to know. And each day they had to tell him they'd found nothing. By October 8th, they admitted utter defeat. Well, that day, Colin heard through a friend of a retired headmaster of a school, Nelson Palmer, who'd located missing items from some of his close personal friends. Mr. Palmer did this, according to the friend, by relaxing, closing his eyes, and describing what his mind seemed to see. Today we call that remote viewing. He was embarrassed by the knowledge that he could do this, never discussed it for fear of being ridiculed. Well, Colin Aiken and the Pinetown office of the South African police were of the same opinion. They had nothing to lose by asking Mr. Palmer to give it a try to find the girl. Senior police officer visited Palmer and his wife that night and finally secured their consent to a meeting on the following day, October 9th, 1956. 50 people sat silently in the two front rooms and hall of Mr. Palmer's home. He leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes. His breathing became heavy and labored. Sweat covered his face and began to trickle down from his chin. For minutes, it was only the sound of his breathing, and many who were present began to suspect that that was going to be the extent of what was going to take place. Then his lips began to move, but the sound that came out of them was a voice like that of a young girl. A young girl in terror. And that voice said, "I'm dead." There was silence for 2 minutes, according to the police account. After that, Mr. Palmer's lips began to move again. "My body's in the ravine near the high rocks. The man has attacked me. He's killing me." Then Palmer opened his eyes, and he seemed to be staring without seeing. A few minutes later, began breathing normally and got up from his chair. According to the record, Mr. Palmer told the witnesses that the girl's body was partially concealed under some stones near a culvert at a spot about 60 miles from Pinetown. The murderer, he said, was a man named Clarence, about 30, who had hidden the murder weapon, whatever it was, in an outbuilding at his home. Mr. Palmer said he believed he could lead him to the place where the body was hidden. Well, 1 hour and 40 minutes later, Mr. Palmer led police to a lonely spot on the highway along the Natal coast. And there, under a culvert and partially hidden by rocks, they found the body of the missing girl. Joy Aiken had been beaten and shot to death. Well, that took care of part of the problem. They found the body. But what about the killer? Palmer described him as a man named Clarence. Relatives recall that Joy had known a chap with that name, Clarence Gordon Van Buren. 10 hours later, police placed Van Buren under arrest. In a shed behind his home, they found a gun that he later identified as the murder weapon. Well, it was the old, old story of a frustrated lover. He lured her into his car, lost his temper, and struck her, and then in a fit of anger, shot her to death. Well, now the question is, how did Palmer know where to find the body? Joy's family prefers to think the dead girl told him, somehow, some way. Palmer scoffs at that idea. He said there's nothing supernatural about it, and he says, "I've found missing pieces of jewelry by the same process, and they certainly don't tell me where they are. I think the human mind has some perfectly normal capabilities that we don't understand, and this projection in time is just simply one of them." Whatever may have been the cause of it, it was certainly accurate in this particular case. Well, sometimes science is applied to mysteries. In this particular case, we're going to talk about the Loch Ness Monster. Now, prior to 1932, Loch Ness was just another of the beautiful lakes that helped make Scotland such an unforgettable place. But November 12, 1932, the era of serenity at Loch Ness came to an end. Hugh Gray, a businessman from Foyers, was taking a walk around the lovely lake, as he had done many times in the past. And it was about midway between Doris and Port Augustus. He stopped to fill his pipe. He was on the northeast side of the point, where he had a good view of that portion of the lake. Suddenly the water boiled up, and a couple of hundred feet from shore, the water was totally bubbling. Then a great black brute of a body welled up from the depths, 40 feet or so, of something gigantic and powerful. It threshed about in the water, occasionally waving a thick pointed tail as though it was struggling with something that kept its head beneath the surface. Well, Hugh Gray happened to have a camera, and he swung it around and managed to take 5 photos before the thing sank beneath the waves and the turbulence subsided. Now, in all his years walking around that lake, he had never seen anything remotely like this. Well, he hurried home and developed the film. They didn't show anything distinctly, but they did show enough to substantiate his report that something exceptionally big and powerful had created a disturbance exactly where he said he had seen it. Now, old-timers around the lake were at least surprised by Hugh's report. The oldsters had seen it too, they said, and they kept quiet because they were certain nobody would believe them. If the monster was really there, it had been there a long, long time. Maybe there was more than one. if there were any at all. Just 6 months after Mr. Gray snapped this picture, a group of wealthy London hunters came to the lake as a guest of a surgeon who had leased some area for a wildfowl shooting along the north coast. And several of these men reported they watched in astonishment as a great, knobby, dark gray body slowly rose to the surface near them, finally projecting a long, snaky-looking neck and a small head several feet out of the water. And they got two pictures of it. Now, they really weren't good pictures because the surgeon who was handling the camera was admittedly shaken by what he was watching. The pictures corroborated the reports of the duck hunters in their subsequent publication of a London newspaper, which fanned the discovery white heat again. And so it was, the Loch Ness Monster was a topic that divided the public into two distinct categories. Those that thought the whole thing was a hoax, and those who stoutly defended the witnesses and accepted the existence of the thing as a unquestioned truth. Naturally, numerous so-called experts of all sorts rushed into print, especially a lot of ivory tower scientists. They dismissed the Loch Ness Monster by such varied explanations as a seal, a sea lion, a crocodile, a white whale, a sturgeon, a catfish, a tortoise, and a rotting tree trunk. Each expert, of course, got his 15 minutes in the spotlight before he was elbowed aside to make room for the next expert. Meanwhile, plans were formulated for a quiet but systematic study of the lake itself. Now, this is a landlocked body of water that ranges down to 700 feet in depth. It was a body of water darkened by the seepage from the peat bogs nearby. Cold water, unfished except for hardy souls who used hand lines near the surface. It was unfished, not well charted, but worthy of study in view of the conflicting claims. Well, Sir Edward Mountain arranged for 20 watchers with binoculars to scan the lake every day, beginning in July of 1934. And their reports developed rather regular appearances of the monster, to such an extent that Sir Edward got some movies of the thing a few weeks later. So this mysterious enigma was seen again from time to time, but it was October 1954 when a bus driver stopped so his passengers could watch the monster playing around on the surface for a full 10 minutes. It wasn't more than 100 yards away. Dark gray, long neck, knobby-looking brute, just as Hugh Gray had seen it so many years before. December 1954, the fishing trawler, Rival, was crossing the lake on her way to drop her nets on the west side when the electronic echo sounder suddenly began to chart an unusual object directly beneath the boat. This underwater radar drew a picture of something swimming in a depth of 540 feet, about two-thirds of the way to the lake bottom. Thing had a small head and a long neck, 8 short legs, a tail about 15 feet long, and the object itself was about 50 feet from tip to tail. Experts who examined the chart said he'd recorded some living creature. So it would seem that radar had proved the existence of a monster in Loch Ness after all the years of mystery and wonder. Well, you know, sometimes people's circumstances can change unbelievably. How about from a ragged urchin sleeping in the gutters to one of the richest men in the world? I would say that's quite an improvement. But it happened to one young man, thanks to a cobra. Now, on this particular day, there were few travelers on the dusty road in India. The heat was stifling. Bandits were numerous. The ruler, called the Gekwar, was a sort of feudal baron whose minions exacted tribute from all who used the road. Travel, of course, was dangerous and expensive, so only the brave or the beggars shuffled through the heat. Shortly after noon that day, when the ruler's toll-takers were dozing at their post, a dirty, ragged boy stumbled up to the little well and furtively snatched a drink of water. And his eye fell on a scrap of food laying beside one of the sleeping guards. It wasn't but a bite, but he grabbed it and ate it. Then he shuffled off down the road a few hundred yards till he came to a little clearing beside the path. There'd been a house there, but it burned to the ground years before, and the weeds had long since covered the remains. The boy stretched out on the grass in full view of the road. I mean, frankly, he was in a condition where he had nothing to lose, and so nothing to fear. In a matter of minutes, he was sleeping the deep sleep of utter exhaustion. But amazingly, he had an appointment with destiny. He went to sleep a beggar, but he woke up to find himself rich and famous. You see, this was the mid-1870s. A Maharaja had tried to poison an agent of the famed East Indian Company. Now, the Maharaja was too powerful and dangerous to be executed, but the incident couldn't go unpunished. So the British deposed the Maharaja for what they call misconduct, a somewhat magnificent understatement. And since the deposed bigwig had no son to succeed him, an immediate search was instituted to provide a suitable successor. The Dowager Maharani sent out agents to scour the countryside. So on this particular sun-baked afternoon, as the countryside lay gasping for breath, the tired and frustrated agents of the Maharani were walking along the road at a time when all other travelers were seeking the shade for naps. And these agents walked in silence. They came at last to the bend of the road where that house had burned down. One of the agents gasped and stopped in his tracks, grabbing the sleeve of his companion. In the clearing a few yards from the road was a light, ragged boy sleeping soundly. And beside him, reared so that its shadow fell across the young man, was a huge, deadly cobra. But it wasn't attacking. In fact, the snake was shading the face of the sleeping boy with its outspread hood. And was it not written, any man above whom the cobra raises its hood is destined to rule? Well, these particular agents were jubilant, for their long, tiring search had come to a dramatic end. So they squatted patiently in the shade of a nearby tree till the cobra went away. And then they woke up the young man and told him of his good fortune. By a superb exhibition of splitting hairs, the authorities discovered, so they said, the beggar boy's ancestors had been mountain kings of a long-lost tribe. And with that vague ancestry, with the more immediate blessing of the cobra's shadow, he became the official ruler of the state of Baroda. Under the benign administration of this particular beggar, the people soon acquired a good education. When he became of age, he took over the reins of a state that had been notorious for corruption and backwardness. In fact, its 3 million subjects were in little more than slaves. Under the benign administration of this peasant boy turned prince, Baroda prospered and its people prospered as well. He saw to it every village had pure water and at least one school and one doctor. He developed and installed a parliamentary form of government, including laws that banned polygamy and child marriage. By the turn of the century, Baroda became an island of freedom and light in a sea of humanity, of human misery known as India. Well, the Gekwar had use for his ingenuity on his own behalf. He wanted to marry the lovely wife of a Hindu prince. Being a Hindu, she couldn't get a divorce, so she became a Mohammedan and got a divorce. And as a Mohammedan, the Gekwar couldn't marry her, so she became a Hindu again and the marriage was reformed. Cupid had strained a point on behalf of this benevolent ruler, even though in reality he was just a beggar boy turned billionaire. All thanks to the shadow of a snake. Well, when there's a killer at large, everyone's upset. And when it's a child killer, they get especially upset. On this particular date, a young man woke up screaming. As he said, he had witnessed a murder while he was asleep. The brutally ravaged body of 5-year-old Dorothy Snyder had been found in the bushes alongside a country lane, where the fiend who killed her had tossed her aside with no attempt to conceal the crime. A witness had seen the child get into a robin's egg blue sedan. Beyond that, there was absolutely nothing except the mute evidence borne by the child's body. The countryside around Mount Morris, Michigan, was in an uproar. Citizens had reason to both be alarmed and angered, because it was a monster in their midst. The corpse of an 18-year-old girl had been removed from the grave and dismembered. Several children, most of them a little older than the ill-fated Dorothy Snyder, had been accosted by a man who made it a practice to remain in the shadows where they couldn't get a good look at him. A midget dressed as a child was secretly brought in as bait for the monster, but the killer was too smart to be taken in by such a ruse. Only once did pursuers even get close through a fluke, and little good it did them, because he jumped nimbly over a fence, climbed a tree, and jumped to a rooftop and vanished. Well, the body of little Dorothy Snyder was found on January 12, 1928. The following night, a group of outraged citizens met at the house of a local businessman for the purpose of forming a posse to hunt down this terrorist. After a brief talk by a local law enforcement officer who cautioned them about taking any hasty action, they heard from Deacon Adolf Hodeling, who added his own warning to those of the officer. Those present knew Hodeling as a fanatically devout man, and they respected him for it. No one took offense when he also cautioned them against taking matters into their own hands. As he reminded them, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And he added, we must ask God's help at a time like this. Suiting the action to the word, he dropped to his knees and prayed silently for several minutes while his audience fidgeted nervously. Finally, he got to his feet and said, gentlemen, I've asked God to help us, and he's promised it to me. Now, there was an embarrassing silence, and the deacon bade the group good night and left. He had an appointment at his church to rehearse a ceremony scheduled for the next Sunday. On that date, Hodeling was elevated to an elder of the church, and 25-year-old carpenter Harold Lothridge was appointed to fill Hodeling's old office as deacon. Services were over at about 10:30. A few minutes past 2 in the morning, Lothridge woke up screaming. His wife turned on the bed lamp. Lothridge couldn't speak for a few moments, and he said, I've had a nightmare, a terrible thing, the most horrible experience of my life. His wife demanded to know what he was talking about, and he said, that child, little girl who was murdered near Mount Morris last week, I was somewhere near where the car drove up. I saw the man that killed her. I could hear the little girl crying. I want to go home. I want to go home. Well, the wife demanded he tell her who it was, and he said, both of us know the killer. It was Adolf Hodeling. Well, Lothridge's wife slept no more that night. He talked it over the next day with his father, who warned him that his story is fantastic and insupportable, and advised him to keep his mouth shut. But the cat was out of the bag. Two fellow workmen overheard Lothridge's discussion with his father. That afternoon, two deputy sheriffs came to talk to him, and he told them about his dream. They decided to squelch the story while they were about it, so they drove over to Hodeling's house where they found him at home. Deputies asked him a few routine questions, including whether he owned a Robin's Egg blue sedan, and Hodeling said, my car's black. But you're welcome to confirm that for himself. So he took him to the garage, and sure enough, the car was black. But as one of the deputies turned to leave the garage, a lodge ring on his finger scratched the car, and beneath the coat of black paint, there was a layer of Robin's Egg blue. Well, Hodeling saw the evidence and lost his composure. Broke down and confessed the whole story. The grave robbing, the murder of Dorothy Snyder, and other outrages that hadn't yet been found. He said, the little girl keeps coming back to me every night, saying, I want to go home, I want to go home. Well, Adolf Hodeling, that pious monster, was adjudged insane and sentenced to life imprisonment. Trapped by the strange dream of Harold Lothridge, of which Lothridge says, I've always felt I was merely the instrument through which God gave us the help that Deacon Hodeling himself prayed for. Once again, the human mind functions in a method that we can never hope to figure out. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of the night show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall. I'm sorry, this is Friday. We'll be back on Monday when once again you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.